You are listening to a podcast from the room behind the bookcase. Welcome, gentle listener, to episode 5 of the room behind the bookcase. And we have what I hope you'll find an interesting and maybe even romantic podcast lined up for you today. Though I will warn you, there's at least some swearing in it, so if that's the kind of thing that's going to really upset you, you probably don't want to listen. This show will feature material from recordings that were made at the Story Museum in Oxford. Claire Murphy and I did a show there called The Four Chambers of the Heart. It was a special Valentine's Day show, and Tom Donegan, who worked at the museum, recorded it for us. After the show, we had a session of questions and answers with the audience, where they could ask us what the Four Chambers of the Heart was all about. I'm going to be playing you that post-show questions and answers session. Then I'm going to talk to you a little bit about a performance of Jonathan and David that I will be doing at the Miller near London Bridge on April the 16th. And then just to play you out, you're going to get to hear another story from Claire Moen Murphy, one of the stories that she told that night in Oxford. So to start things off, here's Claire and myself, ready to explain a little bit about the show, what the Four Chambers of the Heart means to us, and to answer the audience's every question on storytelling and what it's like to tell stories today.
Hi.
Hi. Good evening. Are you well fed and watered? Have you had some light libation? I should mention, because we all keep forgetting, that Claire has some CDs out there, and that's a recording of stories that was live at the Jonesboro Festival in the States. Big storytelling festival they have over there.
Yes, and there's a lot of whooping and hollering because they get really into it, and the audiences are quite.
That's not a criticism of you. There's a lack of whooping and hollering.
No, but yeah. Every audience, every country, like the audiences are very different. And I didn't know when I got there. Like I'd been told they were very big audiences. They're like up to 5,000 in an audience. Wow. But they also get really excited. And the MC for my 10 a.m. on Friday morning whipped them into a frenzy. But like it was 10 a.m. on Friday morning. And to me, like 10 a.m., that's you'd be lucky if you've had a cup of tea by then. And they were into such a frenzy. And I got so excited. I jumped on stage and I said, "Can I get an amen?" And they did say amen. So just know that that's kind of the energy on the CD is like that.
Yeah. Right, okay, enough of that tangent.
Sorry.
Let's kill the tangent. So what we wanted to do is talk a little bit about the Four Chambers of the Heart sort of project that we're both working on, of which this evening's performance kind of arose out of that that project, which is a quest, I suppose, or a mission that a group of storytellers, Claire, myself, we did a lot of work with a wonderful person called Kat Jarrett, who's unfortunately in Berlin at the moment. And then there are other people kind of wider afield, Mats Remen over in Sweden, Ragnhild Morch in Germany. And what we were looking at was stories that followed something less of the kind of like boy meets girl, they live happily ever after together love story that so dominates the inherited tradition that we have.
Not just boy meets girl, but boy meets girl who, and girl is usually rather feeble and can't help herself. And boy does something majestic and then marries her and makes her eternally happy. Just to clarify.
Yeah.
Not that that's not a good story.
It's not a good story, but if it's the only story that you get,
yeah,
then that's a problem. So do you want to talk a little bit, Claire, about what it is that brought you to being interested in these kind of stories?
So I find anywhere where humans aren't treated as equal, I find that quite difficult. So anything from children's rights up to gay rights, up to minority rights, I think it's, you know, we're all humans, we're one race. So I started to get really bored of the male-female storytelling, where the male character had all the strengths, the female was usually weak and in need of something, and then they got married and that solved it. So I started, I know I repeated that point, didn't I? I started talking to my friends around, so I'm part of a much larger storytelling network around the world, and I found out that other people were asking the same questions. around where are these other stories, where are these other love stories, what are the other ways we can tell these stories. And everybody's been researching in different ways. And I think I just wanted to, I think we have responsibility as storytellers, what stories we put into the world. So I wanted to see what else was possible, I think
it's worth sort of talking about the history of storytelling in the UK, kind of the sort of revival storytelling movement that started in the 80s, kind of on the back, I feel, of the folk revival that happened in the 60s and 70s, that groups of people got together and really wanted to reinvent storytelling as an art form in this country, and it had largely been lost. You know, there were places, kind of the Scottish Travellers, I think, were very inspiring to the company of storytellers when they were starting out. There were places where kind of storytelling still existed as a community art form, but by and large, certainly I don't feel like I inherited a traditional oral art form, or if I did, I invented one that had been kind of recreated. I don't know if you felt a bit different.
Well, I don't want to go too deep into it because these people have just had an hour of stories whispered into their ears and hearts, and we're now talking about all the technical, theoretical side of things. So might open it up to questions, just see what people are curious about before we say too much more.
What I wanted to say was that I felt like, for me, those people who did all that work back in the 80s, kind of establishing storytelling as an art form, so built something, like really created it from very, very little. And it's now kind of up to me and Claire and the other people who are kind of stepping into this art form to go, okay, what are we going to do with it? Yeah. With this great, wonderful medium of taking traditional stories that have been passed down for a long time, stories that have been written down and recorded by anthropologists that we're then bringing to life off the page. What am I going to do with those stories? What do I want my impact to be? And what excites me about those stories? But you want to open it up to questions from the floor?
Yeah, because I suppose like we know what we're curious about, but we could, like, we're storytellers, we could talk forever, even alone in a room. So it's very important to meet you wherever you're at. So you might not have any questions, you might have loads of questions, you might have one burning question, but if anybody does have a question, now is the time.
Can I ask, well, you've half answered it, but where do you mainly get your stories from? Are they traditional stories handed down usually?
Everything we told tonight comes from a tradition. So traditional stories are stories that are anywhere from 150 to 3,000 years old. They were oral up until about, 500 years ago when they started getting written down. Mm-hmm. And that's mostly what we tell, but we also remake them, take the story that is familiar, say the devil at the crossroads story, for example, and then recast that in modern times, but you're using the same ideas within the story. Stories themselves are available everywhere, so there's thousands of collections of books, there's also thousands of free archives online, and then I also get a lot of stories from other storytellers, because we tend to share stories between us when you find a really juicy one. Yeah.
What constitutes a really juicy one for you?
It's different for every storyteller, isn't it? I've just answered one, so you grab that. Sorry, so you bring
the tea. I think it's a conversation I've been having a fair bit recently, whether there are like strong, exciting stories, whether all stories are good if they're told well. Right? Obviously, that's a subject for some debate. But for me, there are stories that I'll read or I'll hear snippets of, and they're just exciting. And I want to know what they'll feel like. I want to actually kind of give breath to those stories. And then my wife, bless her, usually gets these kind of rough, rambling, 4 or 5 line meanders through a narrative. And often that's enough. And I think for me, a lot of storytelling is about where I'm at. What is exciting is about where I'm at. So like last year I was up at Edinburgh telling a load of devil stories, like traditional stories about the devil, which I realised I'd been working on. I got ordained as a minister 2 years ago, and I'd been working on kind of like devil stories in the back of my head through all of that process. And the show is kind of it's sort of a little bit about growing up and getting over myself as a performer and things, but like I can see how, because of all the holy, there was a part of me that was really relishing the Beelzebub stories, and like that was what I was getting excited about. Yeah.
So yeah, stories for me that really are juicy are the ones that jump off the page. There's almost a visceral response. Mm-hmm. So story like if you've ever seen the movie Alien, it's kind of like, you know, just, and then it implants in you. Stories that I love are stories that surprise me, and where I don't expect, because I can start a story and go, oh, a boy goes off on a quest. Because I've read so many stories at this stage. So if they surprise me or delight me, that I think I'll be able to delight you.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the sort of the period in which stories that you tell tend to be set. Is it the case that they tend to find themselves situated in a sort of a generalised oldie-worldy sort of setting before electricity, before machinery, in a way that children's stories sometimes do? It's not fixed in a particular period, you couldn't identify it, but it's certainly pre-modern. Would you say that there's some sort of gravitational pull towards that kind of setting?
For me personally?
For
storytellers? Or for storytellers in general? See, I can't speak for storytellers in general because I work a lot with storytellers all over the world, and there's different movements happening in different countries. Mm-hmm. So the Americans are very focused on personal stories. The story is always about the person who's telling it, something that happened to them in their family. They often take myth or folk tales and they just transplant them into modern day America. Mm-hmm. But that's a whole other conversation to have sometime, because that's, they don't have any mythology or folklore to draw from unless they're Native American. So that's where they go to make the story feel real. I like the old stories, the traditional stories, like you say, that are set in this time that you can't quite place, because they've been around for so long, they seem to have a deep structure and a very... a strength and a wisdom in them. Like, they've been around so long for a reason. They've been told, and they've been changed over all the years they've been told. Like, if I told you the original Red Riding Hood, I mean, you might know it, but it's very different to the one we have now. But they've been told for so long that gives them a resonance that modern stories don't really have.
Yeah, and I think it's something like this evening's performance, because all of those stories were nominally taking place within the same world. It was kind of convenient for all of us to sort of draw on this this kind of slightly sort of understood, shared fairy tale world of kings and princesses that you say is a bit pre-modern. There are stories that we tell that are set in the modern world.
Yeah, like you've set your Beelzebub.
Yeah,
Randy
Beelzebub starts in the supermarket. It's a great place to meet the devil. but I think also because... certainly, by and large, I'm working with traditional material, you know, and I'll talk a bit more about myth in a second, but because most traditional material is written in that idiom, unless it's a conscious act of transplantation to a modern setting, and there's lots of reasons to do that, yes, sometimes it's, you know, that's the raw state that the material is found in. Myth, totally different, you know, if we're going to get up and do... something that's definitely definitively Norse or ancient Greek or, you know, Sumerian, if we're going to do like a Gilgamesh or something, then that takes place in its own world with its own landscapes and its own kind of features. Do you want to tell the Aristophanes story now? Is that a good segue into that?
I didn't know they might have more questions.
Okay, well, can we do some more questions afterwards? Or do you want to... Okay.
I'll hold on.
That's a face. All right, we're going to hold off on it. All right. I thought it was a little bit segue. Anyway, any more questions? Yes.
Yes, following nice from your point about mythology and the relationship of stories and that, quite a lot of mythology is obviously poetic. You mentioned Gilgamesh, you mentioned the Norse stuff, the Eddas, and thousands more examples. Is there much of a scene in modern storytelling communities of spoken ballad poetry and epic poetry, and I guess this is tied into the folk vibe as well. So, bit of an open-ended question.
That is a great question. Do you want me to go on answering that one? So, not enormously, and there's a couple of reasons for that. Firstly, most of the storytelling is being done in a very unscripted way. So, like, for this evening's performance, we knew what stories we were going to tell. There are some phrases that we've worked out And the actual words, the words that we use to form the sentences to tell the stories, are improvised to a large extent. And there are storytelling traditions around the world where people improvise long-form poetry. That's amazing. I don't know many people that have that level of technique in the UK. And it's dying out globally. It's like a thing that really is to be cherished and preserved. What's interesting, I think, at the moment is that there are a lot of poets who perhaps have got bored of kind of what's been going on in the slam scene. People like Lucy Ayrton, who's based in Oxford, who are drifting into long-form poetry performances, so taking narratives that last an hour that are in poetic meter, but those are memorised, those are scripted pieces. So to answer your question, in terms of the sort of like the little storytelling niche that we're in, there are not many people doing long-form ballad stuff. Globally, there are a few kind of dying traditions where it's still done that's amazing, and there are, I think, some people kind of rediscovering it from different directions.
But they're taking it away from that poetic form where it's really strict with the lines. What's happening is people are telling the myth that is in those long-form poems. And I have heard of storytellers where they set up a whole weekend to tell the Odyssey. Yeah, and so they have, you know, 16 or 20 storytellers that take episodes.
24, we did a chapter each.
And you stay there all weekend, the audience stays there all weekend, and you tell it all. And then we organise something called a myth-off, which is a little more playful. It's six storytellers, six stories, three rounds, and you pit mythologies against each other. So Norse versus Celtic, Greek versus Sumerian, and the audience votes on the winner. So the reason I bring that up is because what happens
is... it because you keep winning? Like you keep beating
me? I wasn't going to mention that. No, the reason I bring it up is because myth is eternally fascinating, and the form is changing slightly, but people are still fascinated with the stories, so they're finding ways and means to tell them. But like Tim says, there's very few people that have the wherewithal to recite, you know, the whole 20,000 verses. Although, just one last note on that, there was the wonderful article on the Bhopas in India. Did you read that?
No.
So these goat herder farmers, you know about these guys? They have a big competition in the desert for 7 nights once a year, and they have a big saga off, like, kind of, without the audience voting in my case. But they're goat herders and they're illiterate. And what they're reciting is 20,000 verses long. And so somebody went and investigated this, and he said, but like, how do you know what to say next? And the guy said, I don't know what you're asking me. He said, it's like I'm standing on a beach and I turn over a pebble and the first line is on the first pebble. And I just keep turning over pebbles. And so, you know, being a real Westerner, this guy went and taught one of them how to read. And guess what happened? So as soon as he learned how to read, he lost the saga. So just an interesting play on that, anyway.
I think you can read that story in William Dalrymple's Nine Lives. It's a fantastic novel. It's a collection of stories from India.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not there. I mean, they're all true stories.
William Dalrymple's Nine Lives. Good plug. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else that you need to know?
How does a story start?
Once upon a time. Do you mean in the beginning of the beginning? How did it get started?
Because it's just amazing, isn't it, how these stories, and presumably there must be people originating stories now, as we're sitting here, and 300 years from now, those stories will be doing the circus.
Only the good ones are going to last.
Only the good ones, of course, yeah.
But there's a guy, Kendall Haven, who wrote Story Proof, which is really good book on why stories work, but he says we've been making meaning out of the world for 200,000 years using story, that our brains are literally hardwired for story. So the only way I could imagine it, and I've tried to figure it out, but as language grew, I mean, we naturally wanted to convey to people what had happened to us, so first story probably involved a dinosaur and some blood, you know, but it had to arise from experience. And it also, if you look at Karen Armstrong's A Short History of Myth, which is a beautiful book if you want to find out about mythology, you know, myth, the telling of creation myths was a way of bringing communities together and getting people through crisis. So I think the shamans and the medicine people and the holy people would have looked at things like the rising sun and the rising moon and avalanches and earthquakes and needed to know why they happened and needed to give people a reason why they happened. So stories came out of that to explain it, and people would have dreamed of them, would have had visions of them, or they would have just been trying to save a people from madness by giving them a reason why they shouldn't run away from the falling mountain or whatever. Do you know, that's just me piecing it together from various things I've read, but I don't know.
Sometimes I feel like there's a discernible drift towards myth. That, like, you start off just telling family stories, and then sometimes those family stories are so big and so difficult that your children are still telling the stories of their grandparents. And, you know, sometimes something really big and horrific happens, like, say, a massive war, whether that's World War I or the Siege of Troy, and you lose big percentages of all the young men, and those stories are really traumatic, and there's a real sort of need to remember those people, and whether we're going on about the armistice winter truce or whether we're recounting the Iliad, you know, that the stories drift, and then the themes that are resonant endure, and what becomes kind of like a family story drifts into a more of a legendary piece until someone writes it down. And then I think you can kind of almost discern where things have been written down and frozen. I was reading Njál's saga last year. Njál's saga feels like it's been frozen down just on the verge of drifting from a family story into a legend, because there's loads of bits which are like clear digressions of who was sitting in whose house. And you think, what? The only reason why people bothered to remember this bit is because actually they were related to those people, right? And that's why they insisted that that bit had to be written down. Like, that's my uncle, it was his house, it was in there. Whereas something like the Homer stuff with the Iliad, you know, what was about 300 years after the wars, the names are important, the lineages are still important, but it's drifted a little bit more into that mythic scape. And then you get things where, I don't know, when the Babylonians are telling the stories of Sumerian kings like Gilgamesh, and they've become mythic godlike figures. So I think the oral tradition inherently preserves the kind of resonant, salient details, and then overall things drift into a very sort of mythic space until at some point they get sort of frozen, locked in there, or they get forgotten and they don't get told anymore. People work out what needed to be told in that particular family. So I think that's something which I think I'm seeing more and more lately.
Oh,
that one back there.
What makes a difference
between
a myth and a story?
Myth is usually, and this is my definition, not a dictionary definition, there's a lot of interpretation over different types of stories. So a story is any kind of narrative that depicts events, whereas a myth usually involves gods, goddesses, creation stories, that kind of landscape. Would that be a good enough definition?
Yeah, I mean, I think... this is one of those topics where I feel like Wikipedia will probably give a better answer and a more thoughtful
answer. And also
answer.
We could actually answer that for 2 days and somebody would be unhappy with everything that was said.
Probably us, actually.
Yeah.
There was another one just here, and then I think we'll...
Can you please tell us a little bit more about the Four Chains of the Heart and how that project worked?
Yeah, fabulous, good. Oh, I love that. I'm really glad that question got asked. So, at the moment, it is a drive to collect and grow repertoire and to create opportunities where stories that are LGBTQIA, like without wanting to tick boxes, like those sort of queer stories can be shared. So it's an ongoing project that's at a lot of different stages, of which this is kind of one part.
We're based in, two of us are based in London and Tim's up in Nottingham.
Yeah.
And so what we do is we organise events in London where we can take these stories out, and the responses have been good and interested. But what we realise is there's a real need for it. So it's happening as well in Sweden. So one of the people in our extended group is working with some teens who are trans and LGB, and they were really horrified that there weren't enough stories for them. So they went and found more stories and are telling them. And what's really incredible about storytelling is the way it empowers people. It's used to empower people all over the world. I could tell you thousands of anecdotes of ways it's empowered, you know, people who've suffered from war or abused children or whatever. But in this particular scenario, you're dealing with people who are sort of they're at the front edge of a lot of prejudice at the moment. And these stories allow them to have a voice, and that's what's really, really interesting. So we're going to look at getting funding, and we're going to look at joining with some other groups around Europe who are interested in the same thing. And I'd like to look at taking it to festivals around America and around Europe, because it's just interesting to get the conversation going. It's interesting because it's relevant, and we need to be telling these kinds of stories. So we keep talking, and we keep talking with these other storytellers, and we just keep trying to find more and more source material, and particularly source material that's traditional, that's in that pre-modern, as you were saying, time, because it gives more, validation or something to that status. It's like these stories always existed alongside the heterosexual stories. So trying to bring that into balance a bit more. But it's just watch this space. We're gonna keep looking and asking questions and trying to find the juiciest, sexiest, most erotic stories we can. Because everybody likes a bit of juicy, erotic sex, really.
On that note.
No, that's not what's
I didn't even go there. Dirty mind, you're in perfect condition for Valentine's Day. Ed, would you like to tell the season?
Do you want to give it? Shall I go? Sorry. Yeah, I'll just go first. In the beginning, God created all things, and on the seventh day rested. And on the day after that, sent out divine proclamation that every living thing should attend on the celestial presence in the order that it was created. So you've got to imagine the queue that formed. And the front of the queue you couldn't even really see because everything was kind of microscopic and amoeboid. But there was the Holy Presence, and to each and every living thing, God gave the news of the season of its love. Now, whether love exists when all you're doing is dividing cells into other cells, I leave it to your imagination. But eventually, God gets to get on to the fishes. And he told the fishes as to how they would meet, how they would spawn, how they would lay their eggs, how they would fertilise them, and the fishes would all swim away happily. And then the clownfish. The clownfish came in their anemone, and at first God thought that he'd already done the anemone. Then he saw the little clownfish swimming in amongst those fronds and tendrils, and he looked down, and they were all so playful, so childlike, and so joyful that when God saw them, he thought, oh, can I give to them all the burden of adulthood? And he didn't know that he could. So he said, this is how it will be for you, clownfish. You will all be little boys. Except for two in each anemone. Two of you will be adult, one male and one female. And should the adult male die, then whoever is oldest or biggest of the little boys will grow up into adulthood. And should the adult female die, then the adult male will shift into a female, and then the oldest of the little boys will grow up into a male. And so God gave to the clownfish the season of their love, and the anemone drifted off, and the clownfish swam and played happily together, and God went on to all the other fish. He was really excited. He finished off with the salmon, with that great migratory instinct that the salmon has to swim up all of those streams and rivers back to the place of their own original spawning. And I think God kind of got stuck on the migration theme as the birds started to come in. And actually, by halfway, two-thirds of the way through, the birds, it was getting exhausting. And it was the little ruffs. It was the little ruffs that God was explaining that the males and the females would move over enormous distances, and then when they got back together would build their nests, and then the males would dance and the females would choose the bed. You could just see the females kind of... much. It's too much. And we don't even know anything about dancing. How will we be able to choose? And God said, you're right. And they went over to the male ruff, but the male ruffs
had got really into this dancing idea. And they were working, they built a little lek, a little performance arena, and they were there fluffing their feathers and shaking their moves at one another. And God said that he didn't actually have the heart to tell to them that the whole dancing thing was off. So he said, okay, this is what we're going to do. Guys, whoever's the best dancers, you just have sex with each other. And then when the females see that, they'll know that if the lads are getting it on together, that means they're really hot and you're the ones that they will all mate with. And so God gave to the roughs the season of their love, and they all went away very, very happily. And so it went on. And there are many stories that I could tell you. But at the back of the queue, there were you and I. There were men and women, Adam and Eve. We were there in that line. And in front of us were the horses. And the horses went in to the celestial presence, the holy presence. And there was God. And God explained how the mare would carry the foal inside of her. I think it's 11 months. And eventually it would be born. And the thing would stretch out. The little foal would stretch out its legs and stand. And Mare got so ridiculously overexcited that as they turned to leave the holy presence, she kicked out behind her. And she caught God in the chin. So when we went in to the celestial presence to see God, to find the season of our love, well, there was the Holy One, mouth covered by his hand, complaining. And it was really hard to hear what God had to say. And when I told this story to my wife, as I said, I often mumble through these stories to my wife, she interrupted me at the end and she said, I know what God said to us. He said, go fuck yourself. And that's what we've been doing ever since. And maybe she's right. Maybe she's right that that mumbled message was so hard to hear. And all we've been doing ever since is reaching out to see if we can catch the whisper of the echo. Thank you.
So that's where I think that comes from.
Well, I heard a different story. I could be wrong, and it was before the queue. It was before the amoeba and the anemone. I always struggle with that word, anemone. And before the horses and the people, before all of that, God made all the universe. Out on a breath, and a song. And she pulled planets out of the dark void. And she looked down at one particular planet and she gave it a bit more attention. She made it blue and green, and she raised up the earth, and she pulled up trees. And before all of that, she let loose the vices and the virtues. They were let loose to roam free on the planet. And there they were, all of the vices and the virtues. You know, anger, creativity, rage, imagination, serendipity, all these wonderful vices and virtues. And creativity looked around and said, I know, let's play a game. And everyone said, great idea. And creativity said, let's play hide and seek. And madness stepped up and said, I want to be it, I'm it, I'm it. Everyone else go hide. I'm going to start counting. 1, 5, 53, elephant, baboon. And madness, as madness counted, all of the vices and virtues began to slip away. And cleverness took off his shoes so he could slip away quieter. And the other vices and virtues saw this. They thought that was quite clever. So they took off their shoes, left them there, snuck off. Mischief came along. Saw all the shoes. Tied them all together. Giggled. Went off and found a hiding spot. Stealth covered herself in mud and leaves and stood by a tree. And Patience was standing right in front of Madness when Madness finally uncovered his eyes. Patience said, oh, is it time to hide? Madness said, gotcha. And Madness made his way through the forest, found serenity down on the beach, contemplating a grain of sand. Found rage because there was this huge hole in the ground where she had been beating her fists. And one by one by one, all of the vices and all of the virtues were caught. All of them were caught. Except for one. One was not caught. And that meant Madness had not won the game completely. The one that had not been caught was love. Madness did not like to lose. Love! Come out now! Game's practically over! Where are you? Now, Madness had looked all the way up the mountain, down by the beach, everywhere. Except for the forest floor, which was covered in leaves. So he got a stick, and he sharpened it. Love, come out now. Not a sound. So he took the stick, and shoo, shoo, shoo. Ah! And he pulled up the stick, and there was red on it. And out from the leaves emerged love. And she had her hands over her eyes. And she said, Madness, what have you done? What have you done? And Madness looked at love and said, oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, love, I didn't mean to. Madness, I can't see. And Madness said, oh, it's all right. Here, give me your hand. And Madness helped love find her way out of the forest. Which is why to this day, love is blind. And wherever you find love, Madness is usually close behind.
Thank you so much, guys. That was wonderful. Okay.
Always an honour to share a stage with Claire Murphy. And now I want to talk to you about a show that I'll be doing in London at The Miller, which is on Snowfields Road near London Bridge, on the 16th of April as part of Night of the Storyteller. But it starts back in 2013 when the Hidden Perspectives Festival, that's a group that's organised by Sheffield University Bible Studies Department, they came to me and said, we're interested in queer Old Testament stories, well, queer Bible stories just in general. And I said, oh, okay, that sounds interesting. And they said, yeah, we'd really like you to do a show for us. And I said, okay. And the more I talked to them, the more I realised that I did really want to get involved with them. But I also wanted to preserve what I felt was the essential sacred nature of the biblical text, which for me, I was training to be an interfaith minister at the time, was something very, very important. Thankfully, on that training, looking to become ministers themselves, there were friends of mine who were gay. And so I talked to them, interviewed them about their life histories with regards to religion and with regards to sexuality. And a lot of them mentioned the Bible story of Jonathan and David as being important to them. So slowly in my mind, this show came together for the Hidden Perspectives Festival that was the Jonathan and David Bible story from the books of Samuel, but interwoven with moments from the interviews of these gay people of faith, just to show all the resonances between this ancient holy text and the lived experience of people who wrestled with questions of sexuality and religious identity. It's a really important piece to me, and I'm really delighted to be getting a chance to tell it in 2015. So that's the 16th of April at the Miller on Snowfields Road as part of Night of the Storyteller, Tailspin Theatre's project. There'll be loads more details about that online. It'd be great to see you there. And before I say goodbye, I just want to play you one more story from Claire Murphy, recorded at the Oxford Story Museum. This is her telling an Indian myth, and I think it's a wonderful example of the kind of traditional material that we're finding that honours the questions of gender identity and roles within society that are so pertinent today. Take it away, Claire.
It was a long, long time ago when two best friends who had grown up together, two young men who had been born in the same month, and they both got married within 6 months of each other, and turned out both of their wives got pregnant at the same time. They were delighted. What fortune is this that you and I will have children at the same time? It is like we are truly brothers. But we're not brothers. So, I have a proposition for you, my friend. Why don't we arrange that our children get married? And the other, the second man, he said, this is brilliant, of course, and then we will actually be family and we'll spend all of our lives together. Wonderful, wonderful. And they shook on it. Two men shook on this before the babies were born. First baby arrived. I believe that's how it happens. Those of you who've given birth might correct me on that one. I believe they shoot out and are caught. First baby was born. It was a beautiful, beautiful little baby girl. And everybody oohed and aahed over her. The second woman went into labour within the month and she gave birth. And it was a beautiful, beautiful baby girl. Now this was a real problem, you know, for the father, because he had already made a deal. And he had made such a strong, I mean, he'd made such a huge, important thing about this deal. He had talked about it for 8 months with his friend and with everyone. And now he had a daughter. It wouldn't do. Couldn't change it. He decided he would name her a boy's name. Dress her in boy's clothes. And let what will be. He'd keep his side of the deal. And so the girl was raised as a girl, dressed as a girl with a girl's name, and she was taught all the trades of women. And the second child was raised as a boy. She was dressed in the clothes of a boy, she was given a boy's name, and she was taught all of the trades of men, as far as could be taught. Because obviously, she couldn't go into the bathhouses, could she? She couldn't go into the toilets with the other boys. There were certain things she was excluded from, but the rest of the time, she was walking around as she could, wearing herself in a boy's clothes. And the two grew up, kept separate, of course, because they were due to be married. The wedding day came. There was a huge ceremony, there was a big celebration. You're not interested in any of that, though, are you? You're thinking about what comes next. It's where the brain just naturally goes. We'll indulge. Right. So, ceremony's over, people have all left, and you've got the wife and the husband-wife in the bedroom chamber. Now, wife has been prepared for this. She's been taught what to do, so she gets herself ready, she takes off her clothes, and she gets onto the bed to prepare herself. She's ready. She's waiting for this moment she's been taught about. And now it's husband-wife's turn. Husband-wife deliberates a little bit because she's quite nervous about what's about to happen. She doesn't really know how it's going to go because her mother's the only one she's ever dealt with, you know, in terms of her naked body. And wife is lying on the bed. Is there something wrong, husband? No, it's fine. I'll just join you on the bed. So husband-wife, very carefully, takes off her layers. And when she gets down to the last of them, wife looks up. But you're just like me. Yeah. So the thing is, says husband. And she began to tell the story of her father, the story of her life, story of being raised as a boy and dressed as a boy in a boy's name. And as she talked, she sat on the edge of the bed and wife wrapped herself up in a blanket and sat up and they began to talk. And they told stories all night long. And by the end of the night, it was such a strange tale. And wife turned and she looked at her husband wife and she said, well, it's been arranged. We are married. So I guess we'll just carry on. All right, said husband wife. And they fell asleep. And as each night passed after that, they would spend the night talking. And they would start making each other laugh. And from the laughter came singing. And with the singing came lying closer together. And then came the kissing. And the kissing was so good, other things soon followed. You get the idea. They fell in love after getting married. It was a wonderful thing. It doesn't happen to everybody, but it was a good thing. And the first year was blissful. The first year was all discovery. And remember, wife had been raised as a woman, so she knew all of the arts of being a woman, and husband-wife knew none of this. So in the second year, when husband-wife would get home from work, wife would have laid out some silks and satins, and she began to teach husband-wife about how it was to be a woman. It was quite nice. Husband-wife quite enjoyed the feel of the silk and the satin and walking around with the loose air and all areas and learning about makeup and hair. It was wonderful. Second year was all of this learning. As they moved into the third year of their marriage and they walked around the house arm in arm and they talked of many things, of their future, what they would do, wife got an idea into her head, and it was one of those ideas, I don't know if you've ever had one like this, but it just kind of takes root and it just won't go away. And it kept sort of scratching at the edge of her mind until finally she said it one day to husband-wife. She said, listen, I know you're a woman, you know, and you know you're a woman, and you know, probably everybody knows you're a woman. So why hide? Why don't we just go out as two women? And husband-wife said, I don't know if that's a good idea. All right, never mind, forget it. But you know the way it goes. It came up again and again and again in conversation until husband and wife was worn down by it. And she said, all right, fine. This Sunday, when we go on our walk through the village, I will dress as a woman. Are you sure? Yes, I'm sure. Oh, it's wonderful. I've got a dress all picked out for you. Great. So that Sunday, 3 years of being together, we got into their beautiful dresses. Makeup was perfect. The hair was up. And they stepped out together. And as they walked through the streets of their village, a deep, unsettling silence filled the air. Because you see, it's one thing to sort of know something is going on, but it's something else entirely when it's put in your face. They had always guessed that something wasn't right about husband-wife, but now, well, now it couldn't be avoided. Now look at the two of them walking down the street together like that. So first, people whispered. But then the whispers took on a sort of edge and the volume increased. And wife and husband-wife began to hear things from the mouths of children, children who'd heard things from the mouths of adults inside their own houses. And soon after the harsh words that they heard, soon after that came stones, little pebbles thrown at their windows. Until one night, a great big stone came through and broke all of the glass and shattered it all over the floor. And husband, wife, and wife jumped up together. And they looked at each other in the dark and they knew that after that large rock, it could only get much, much worse. They grabbed a coat each and they fled under cover of darkness. And they ran from the village. And they ran as far as they could into the darkest place they could find. They ran deep into the forest. And they ran without looking where they were going, and the trees pulled at their cheeks and at their clothes. And they ran deep until they got to a house, a skeleton of a house with broken windows. But still it had walls. It had a door that closed. It was something safe for them. So they ran inside the house and they collapsed, the two of them. In each other's arms, they fell to the floor. And with the relief that comes from knowing you're still alive, they held on to each other. And as their hearts calmed down and their breathing grew regular, that's when they heard it. They heard the house whispering. No human voice, but a whispering, a seething, slickering whispering. And they looked around and they couldn't see anything, but they could hear voices everywhere, coming from every crack and crevice. And then little billows of smoke began to gather, and they watched as this black smoke rose up from a great hole in the floorboards, and this face of a ghost in front of them. And all of the voices joined as one great voice, and it spoke at them. Get out! Get out before we do you real harm! And Wife was backing towards the door. You know, like an intelligent human does. Not like most of the people in the horror story. She was ready to go. And husband wife grabbed her hand. And she looked at this ghost thing and she said, no, we're not going anywhere. Now, in all his years haunting that house, yeah, no one had ever talked back, right? Mostly what he had seen of humans was the back of them as they fled and tears and sweat sort of pouring from their bodies. This was really unusual. He was quite intrigued. And so he lost his slightly scary air and he said, I'm sorry, what? And she said, we have seen more darkness in our own people than you can ever show to us here. We have nowhere else to go. We're staying. If you'll have us. Well, now the ghost wasn't just intrigued. Now he was being asked to be a host. And all he had was these terrible other little ghosts to hang out with. Here were two really interesting women. So he said, all right. You can stay. You can stay if you, you know, tell me stories now and again. You can stay in this house. And husband and wife said, we will be glad to. And so it was that the ghosts haunted the house all night while the two women slept. And during the day, they got up and did what they could do to make it home. And the years passed. And it was all right. Except, I don't know if you've ever had this experience where you've lived in an isolated place with maybe just one other person and a bunch of spirits. But it can be a little bit, you know, lonely making. And wife started to feel it. She started to feel the lack of human company, the lack of human culture, the lack of the music and the art and the conversation. I mean, she loved husband and wife. She was great company and everything, but it's only the one person. And one day she said it. She said, husband and wife, I love you and I love our life. I really miss it. I miss the other world. And husband and wife said, do you remember what they were like? Yeah, I remember. But if there was any way we could get back there. And the ghost was listening. And the ghost came forward and said, well, you know, I do have some power available to me. If you really want to go back, I can make husband wife a husband. They stared at each other. Did they really want this transformation? And wife thought of all the things they would get back if they went back to their village amongst their own people. And husband wife, they looked at each other and they agreed. And so husband wife turned to the ghost, and the ghost, using the magic that we can only dream of that comes from that other dimension, the ghost channeled all of that magic, and through his smoky breath he issued the transformation. So the female became the male. They said goodbye to the ghosts who had been such good hosts, and they made their way back to the village. And it is a strange thing that we humans, we know it when it happens. Everyone in the village knew the transformation had happened without being told. Something in the way that husband and wife walked now. There was some sort of weight. Some sort of certainty. And they were accepted. They were just accepted and welcomed back as if nothing had happened. They went back to their house. The window had been fixed. Within a day of being back in their house, they were receiving all kinds of invitations to dinners and to parties and to little festivals. And then husband and wife started to get invitations from the men. Invitations that he had never gotten before. Invitations to the bathhouse. Invitations to these long conversations after dinner with the brandy and the cigars. Be allowed into that other world. And it was so intriguing that husband and wife stayed out late, night after night after night. And wife, you know, she thought she knew what it was like to be lonely back in the house of the ghosts. But it was nothing compared to this. Back amongst all the people and with the one true love you're supposed to love, feeling lonelier than ever. Built up in her till she couldn't contain it anymore. And a few weeks had gone by, she'd barely seen her husband. And he came in one night and she couldn't help it, you know. The voice flew out of her. She didn't mean it to be so narky and so bitchy, but, you know. She said, "Well, where have you been?" He said, "What? I haven't seen you in weeks. And I've had to do all the housework. And I, what she wanted to say was, "I miss you and I wish you'd stay a bit more." But she didn't say that. She complained and her voice got higher and higher. And husband and wife looked at her. And a rage rose up in him like he had never known in his life. And the rage rose up and up and up. And his hand went up to strike her. And wife saw that hand in the air, saw the intention of it to hit her. And her voice died in her throat. And she turned on her heel and was gone. She walked out of the house and out of his life. And husband, wife, she'll be back. She'll be back in a couple of hours when she cools down. She wasn't back. She wasn't back the next morning, nor the next evening. And as the days passed, husband, wife, in that silence, began to remember leaving her alone all that time. And he began to repent. And he knew where she must have gone. So he made his way to the dark heart of the forest, to the house of the ghosts. And sure enough, there she was, but she wouldn't look at him. And he bowed down before her and he kissed her feet and he kissed her hands. And he said, "I'm more sorry than you can ever know." He turned to the head ghost and he said, "Change me back to who I really am." And the ghost, with that other world magic, took away the male and returned the female. And wife and husband-wife embraced each other. And they lived a long and happy life in that dark and haunted house.
So you dance the jig of life in a dead man's arms, unable to stop just like a merry-go-round horse. He has paid the fee like any other man and deserves no less than the nimblest of your moves.
The Room Behind the Bookcase is created by Tim Ralphs. For music details, links, and a list of upcoming gigs, go to timralphs.com.